Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So this week, fall, late summer, but fall weather has arrived.
It feels like fall.
Oh, it's glorious. My favorite season. When you're a kid, summer is your favorite season.
Summer's hot.
Well, kids in New England, summer is your favorite season. In Texas, I suppose maybe summer wasn't your favorite season.
Well, you're not in school, so that's fun. And you get to go to the pool all the time. That's fun.
When I was a kid, obviously summer was the best because you weren't in school.
Right.
At some point, I liked spring. Because it was the warm up and, you know, spring is, you know, a little joyful. But then I realized in New England, spring is sort of leafless and
muddy
bugs. And you get more cold than warm. Well, you know, until bam, slap in the face summer. Like, oh, it's like 50 degrees out again today. 95. It seems like that June hits and boom, you're either like raining all month or it's 95. But fall in New England is the best season. We've still got leaves on the trees. It's no longer hot and humid. We have days of 70 degrees, 75 with sunshine and no clouds. Oh, and then the leaves start to turn and everything is in bloom and there's all kinds of fresh vegetables and apple picking, which maybe we'll do next week.
Maybe.
Melanie's favorite word. And then, pumpkins and the whole thing. And like, and you can still get pretty decent weather through Halloween. We've had many times where I've sat giving out candy on Halloween in shirt sleeves because it was 80 degrees.
Sometimes it's really cold.
And then there were the years, I think, what was it, last year or the year before, where it was pretty cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cold and wet. And
it was a short candy hunting expedition.
It was.
I've gotten stuck with doing that the last two times. I'm not sure how I end up doing it, but I end up getting stuck with that.
With what? Going out?
Yes.
Trick-or-treating?
Because the kids want it. Not that you've stuck me with it, but because the kids request me to take them.
You're more fun because you go for longer, I think.
I think that's what it is. I've shot myself in the foot.
You dug your own grave there.
Apropos for Halloween.
Yes.
I know.
I do not dispute with you that autumn in New England is my favorite season.
Yes. I can, and that's interesting because I'm trying to think about now, like, what would be my favorite season if I lived somewhere else? Like, in Ohio, when I lived there, summer was pretty darn nice. But the late spring in Steubenville was pretty good. I have to say, like, April and May in Steubenville was pretty nice. But, like, in Texas and Austin, what would be the best season? Because September there is still pretty stinking hot, right?
Well, yeah, September is, but like October's nice.
Yeah. October and March.
Yeah. I like April. April's a good month. By May, you're starting to, like, the beginning of May can be cool.
Yeah.
But like mid May,
it's hot.
It can be brutally hot. Like, I remember being when I was in college, like, they had not yet turned on the AC in the dorms. For graduate, and it was graduation weekend, and it was just
brutal.
It was brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so we've taken advantage, or you took advantage. I was working, but you took advantage of the nice weather, the fall like weather on Labor Day. I labored on Labor Day. I hope you all appreciate I was making podcasts. But you and Bella and Lucy went for a scout. Expedition, a hike.
Yes, we went back to Ponkapog Pond, which we've been to
a year ago.
This was my third time.
Yeah.
Last year, the big scouts
went.
And in the spring, the Cubs.
Yeah, we went with my den.
Anthony's den.
At the very beginning of COVID. It was like the last free weekend where people were actually out. Nobody was wearing masks, but we were still kind of distancing.
We were standing a little bit further apart.
Which ended up not happening at all, and we were all bunched up at some point. But
I think that there was still some sort of conscious distancing going on.
In fact, I think that Monday was when the order came down for lockdown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We knew it was coming.
It was last time we were out.
Yeah. It really was. It was kind of...
kind of weird,
funny in retrospect.
Yeah, but and then this is your third trip out. So is it?
I really like the Ponkapog hike.
Yes, especially with kids.
It's really nice. I mean, it's a long hike. We did the whole loop around the pond.
Yeah, that's a long. We didn't do that with the
which
Cubs.
Is like 4 miles.
Yeah,
a little bit more. Took us about 3 hours. Well, actually, the loop around the pond is a little bit shorter, but we also went out on the boardwalk into the bog and then back, so that has a little bit of distance.
We've talked about it before, but there's a quaking bog in the pond.
It's really cool.
And which is, I think, unique to New England. It's a unique geographical feature.
They exist in other places, but this is the one quaking bog in New England.
Is it? Oh, okay. I thought it was like a unique geographical feature, but okay. Well, so it's essentially like, it looks like land. But it's just really thick mat of vegetation sitting on water, essentially. It's like thick enough to hold a tree, like small trees, but trees grow in it. And you could maybe in places walk on it, I would think. They don't want you to because they're trying to preserve it. But
right. The boardwalk was started by a professor who was taking his his kids out, his students out to the bog. In the wintertime when it was frozen over.
Right.
And then eventually decided, we could float some logs and then we could come out here like at other seasons of the year. And then they did that. And eventually like that became sort of.
They made a more permanent structure. So the cool thing about the quaking bog is also it has carnivorous plants.
Yeah. We saw some pitcher plants this time, which I had not seen on my previous outings.
Which people call what Venus flytrap.
No, it's not the same as a Venus flytrap.
But people think of, when people think of carnivorous plants, they think of Venus flytrap.
They think it's of Venus flytrap.
It's the same family of sort of the same kind of plants.
Same idea. A pitcher plant doesn't close like a Venus flytrap does. It's just, it's got a long, it's like a leaf that's made into kind of a funnel.
Yes.
And the inside is sticky with hairs that point the wrong way, so
a fly goes in, but don't come out,
and doesn't come out. Yeah,
he checks in, but he doesn't check.
And there's
out.
Like a thick, sappy sort of liquid inside that digests it. Yum. We also saw we saw frogs and
snake, dead one or a live one?
No, a live one.
Oh,
like slithering through the leaves.
Yeah,
there's a little garter snake.
Yeah,
not a big deal, but cute. And, so we split up into two groups. The Cubs went one way and the
BSA scouts, the girls.
The girls went the other way. Well, the girls plus the Weebelows.
Oh, right. The older Weebelows.
Yeah, we had about 20 kids plus adults. So we divided into two groups of 10.
Because they're not allowed to have...
They're not supposed to have...
The scouts does not allow more than 10 in a group.
Although, honestly, there were a couple more, like one extra in each group. I think there's 11 per group.
Shh. Don't tell them. Anyway.
What are you going to do? There's 11 people. You're going to make like.
Sorry,
some
Timmy.
Of them...
you've got to go.
Sorry, you got to go back home.
Timmy, come take a closer look at this really giant pitcher plant.
So I thought it went really well. I mean, all the kids and adults were wearing masks when we mustered at the trailhead.
Yeah.
And a lot of people wore the masks through most of the hike.
Yes.
But there was some, taking masks off on the trail when we were distant from each other. And, of course, we had some snack breaks, but everyone was really good, I thought, about like
keeping their distance.
Yeah, not being too close. We did have one cub who lost her mask because she was hiking while eating chocolate chip cookies. And the mask was like, I think, looped around her wrist and then fell off. Fortunately, because we each did the loop in opposite directions, her brother was in the other group. And so as they looped our trail, they found he found the mask for her.
And the Cub Master was prepared because he's a scout.
Because he's a scout.
And he had extra masks.
Extra masks in his pack. So all was good.
All was good. Good. So sounds like a successful time. The other three kids stayed here with me. They did their thing while I was working.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish I could do these things, but it's just, you know, the timing is often difficult for me to go.
It was fun. I was very tired afterwards.
4 or 5 miles.
It was a good workout. Yeah.
Closed your rings.
I did multiple times.
Man, like 5 years ago, people go, what? Closed your what? Now everybody knows what that means. The other thing that we wanted to talk about was a school related thing, which was Bella's latest excitement about a subject or a book.
Right.
We always talk about, I have to stop here and say, we always seem to talk about Bella's interests in, like, her academic interests. The others have their interests too, but because she's the first, when the others discover these things, it's not quite like it. It sort of feels like the elephant in the room. Like, it feels like we're like favoritism toward the oldest. What do you think of that?
Okay, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I've sprung it on you, but it's not favoritism so much as the oldest, she is engaging in things very interesting to us. Like the younger ones are kind of following along, and they're kind of, they pick up the things that she's done, but Bella also has a particular way of diving headfirst into a subject that makes teaching her and engaging with her in these things very interesting for us.
Right.
So anyway, that said, what's her
latest interest? So we started homeschooling high school, as we talked about. We finished our second week, and she's still just as enthusiastic about it, which is great. I'm really loving that. But I had to chuckle because one of the textbooks I was having a very hard time finding. I was in tears. I knew that it was going to be her favorite book because she loves history. And it was Churchill's History of the English Speaking Peoples, which she's using for British
history. It's a classic, as people know.
Right.
Yeah.
And but the syllabus that we're following calls for the abridged version. It's like a one volume abridgment of what is a 4 volume set. And I was having the hardest time finding it. Fortunately, one of the other homeschool moms like clued me in that there was a reprint. And so I was able to buy it. And then, of course, what happens? But Isabella notices on the first day that she's assigned readings from this book. And she says, is this an abridgment? I think there's something missing. I want to know what's in the other volumes.
I don't want to know what you're keeping from me.
And so, ironically, I ended up getting the 4-volume set from the library this week. And I'm thinking, this is really huge. But she really does want it. I didn't know which volume would be the one that she was most interested in. So I just went ahead and put all 4 volumes on hold. And I get to the library and it's a pile. And I brought them home and she was thrilled. And she immediately, like as soon as she finished her schoolwork for the day, she was diving into the supplemental reading of Churchill's
History
of the English Speaking People. She was really wanting to know what Churchill said about American history.
Because the abridgment leaves out a lot of the non-Britain stuff.
Right.
Because this is English speaking people. So it covers the whole Commonwealth and the former colonies and every place where people speak English.
Right.
So. My guess is the abridgment covers mostly Great Britain.
I think so. I confess that I haven't spent as much time looking at it as I'd like.
And if you're wondering, yes, it's that Churchill. It's Winston Churchill who wrote this before he was prime minister, after?
I don't know, but I would suspect after.
Yeah, I guess after he'd retired.
Churchill was, he was a really amazing guy.
Yes.
And I would really love to have the time to read these books myself. I don't know that I do right now, but it's definitely on my reading list. Like, this looks really good. I love his style. He writes so beautifully.
I want to see that movie that was out a few years ago about Churchill that had, what's his name playing him? The guy who always plays the bad guy.
I have no idea.
I always do this. He was the bad guy in the several movies, which are not coming to me, so I will have to leave that up to the listener to figure out.
I liked there was a Churchill episode that focused mostly on him in the first season of the BBC television series The Crown. I really liked the Churchill episode. It was good. Like, he's such an interesting character.
I'm trying to think of what was the... Was it... No, it's not Brian Cox's Churchill. And it wasn't Brendan Gleeson or Albert Finney. Or Ian McKellen, which would it sounds weird.
Ian McKellen.
Gary Oldman played Churchill.
Seriously?
Unrecognizably. Let me see if I
can find it. I sort of remember that.
Gary Oldman.
That was weird.
Yeah, I saw the name Gary and I said, oh, yeah, here he is. That's Gary Oldman as Churchill. I'm showing you the picture from the movie The Darkest Hour, which was Best Picture of the Year.
Right.
And Best Actor.
I never did see that.
So I think, yeah, going to have to pick it up.
We could go on a Churchill binge.
Churchill binge. Yeah.
Watch all the
Gary
Churchill
Oldman
movies.
As Winston Churchill. Like, yeah. You just don't like. I think Father Chip was telling me you just don't. You don't recognize him.
How much of that is like him putting on weight, and how much is makeup?
A little of both, I think.
A lot of makeup actually, because he doesn't look anything like Churchill.
Right. So
movie magic.
So Bella and the History of the English Speaking Peoples.
Yeah. So it gets a definite two thumbs up. She says that so far she's really liking almost all the readings.
It's very interesting talking to you when your child reaches an age where they have an independent opinion. I mean, she doesn't have a lot of experience in the world, but she has an independent opinion and a good mind, and she's become well read. She's listened, and
she's not afraid of expressing her opinion,
right? Like all teenagers, and but yet she's interesting to talk to include into a conversation.
Which reminds me of my favorite line from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yes, you left when you finally got interesting.
You were just getting interesting.
Right, which is, I remember someone having an interesting point about that is raising children is turning your children into the sort of person you want to hang out with, and then they leave.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when my mom, like, was so sad when I went away to college.
Because you probably were finally at that point where you were an interesting person to hang out with.
Yes, I understand that now because I'm sort of not looking forward to that day when...
When they all flee the nest.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I understand now.
And now that we've got a high schooler, that feels a lot closer.
Right. Well, and now I understand more of the parents who welcome back the children after college and let them stay with them for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I get it. All right, let's move on to what we've been eating this week before we get all maudlin and melancholy.
Yeah, mushy.
Because it is the fall, and that's not when you get maudlin or melancholy, I guess.
It's true.
So speaking of the fall, it is soup season.
It is soup season.
And
finally cool enough to make my favorites. And the farmer's market has the beautiful produce that I want to make into soups.
Yes.
So last Saturday, we were at the farmer's market, and I saw the gorgeous bunches of carrots. And even though I had the bunch of carrots in the fridge that I hadn't cooked from the previous Saturday's farmer's market, I said, I want to make carrot soup out of those carrots. They're so beautiful. And Dom, who likes to support my cooking madness, said, let's get another bunch of carrots then and make carrot soup.
Yes. And so you made ginger carrot soup.
Oh, it was so good. It was
ginger and carrots, a match made in heaven.
It had ginger and garlic in it and some red pepper flakes. So it had kind of a nice kick to it. And some white wine, and I added onions and celery too. So it was not just, I saw some recipes out there that were just like 5-ingredient
right.
ginger carrot soup. Mine was like 20-ingredient ginger carrot soup.
Right. You added some dairy, right?
Oh, yes. I added some butter and I'm trying to remember, like we didn't have.
Was it cream, half and half?
I think I used some sour cream and some half and half because I didn't have any heavy cream.
Right.
I also added some coconut cream, which I think was a great decision.
Right.
Like the the coconut has that beautiful coconut flavor.
Yeah, when you buy the can of coconut milk, it's always separated, the liquid. And,
well, if you buy the good brands.
If you buy the good brands, the liquid and the thick stuff. And so the thick stuff is the cream. And yeah, you add that in. It's good in curries. A carrot curry would be interesting. A carrot coconut curry with the ginger and garlic.
I could totally go for that.
So the ginger carrot soup was really good, and you made croutons with it.
Yes, I had some leftover Asiago bagels, and I toasted them, tossed with some butter and olive oil and lots of garlic and some herbs. They made such good croutons.
Anthony was eating them out of the bowl.
Anthony did not want to eat the soup.
The croutons are for the soup, Anthony. If you want a crouton, you have to eat the soup. The soup was really good, but interestingly enough, it's not a main course. It was very rich, so it was enough for it to be like an appetizer's worth.
Yeah,
because we knew that most of the kids wouldn't want it. So we also, chicken thighs or something. I think we had chicken thighs that night.
I do not remember what we had.
I think it was chicken thighs. And so we had chicken thighs and some other veg, like green beans or whatever, for that everyone could have. So I had a bowl of soup and like an appetizer size bowl of soup. And that was plenty. And that's not a knock on it. I think there are more dishes should be just an appetizer's worth. You don't want to eat a big bowl of something. Now, you may have felt differently about it.
Well, I actually probably could have just made a meal out of the soup. It was so good.
Yeah.
The trick with that is that soup takes time to cook. And if you hadn't been here to make the secondary stuff, I would not have had the bandwidth to do soup and a main course. I don't know how people do that.
Well,
maybe that's why you make the 5-ingredient soups.
Right. Well, yeah, there's that. Or pressure cooker, Instapot soups or crock pot soups or that sort of thing. But I think actually if you make the soup ahead of time, I think that's a big part of it.
Well, but I don't have time to make the soup. I mean, again,
I know.
Who has time?
Well, there are people who have time. They just have different things that they're doing. Some people
are not homeschooling 5 kids, you mean?
Right. Or they just they don't write poetry or paint. They make soups and cook things. I mean, you cook a lot of stuff. You have time to cook. You just cook a lot of different things. And so this isn't one of those things you would have taken time to cook. You made muffins or granola or bread.
Oh, goodness gracious, yes.
And sometimes all of those things in a day. So you have time. You just, your time is taken up with making other things.
Not often enough.
Right. But no, what I'm saying is your time is just allotted differently than other people would.
But I would love to be able to make a soup course for dinner most nights.
Yeah.
And I just.
It's hard to do.
Yeah. Not going to happen.
Well, the other soup you made was a sausage and tomato soup, which is, I think that undersells it because it was almost like a sausage minestrone soup.
Yeah.
Without any pasta in it because of so Lucy could eat it.
Right. It was a really hearty vegetable soup, and it was mostly an excuse to use up the leftover sausage and
leftover grilled Italian sausages. A great way to use them.
Yeah. It had, of course, your onion, carrot, and celery. It had zucchini and tomatoes and chickpeas and green beans. I think another kind of bean, red beans.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was all
lots of basil.
All kind of mushrooms, probably.
I don't think there was mushrooms.
No, there wasn't mushrooms in it. Mushrooms, I mean, there could have been a good mushrooms in it. It could have been a good addition. But but it was really good, really hearty. I ate it for several days afterward for lunch because it was just so good. And like a lot of soups, it gets better the longer it sits in the in the fridge until it doesn't. But I think I ended up eating it all up afterward. The kids do not. There are some leftovers the kids will eat, and there are some leftovers they won't touch.
They usually don't eat leftover soups, except for Lucy. She's about the only one who'll eat leftover soup.
Yeah, I like soup. So.
Or Bella will eat the chicken lemon soup if it's leftover. That's the only exception.
That's true. They have their things that they'll eat. So another dish we made this week, with not a soup, This one was sort of inspired by Father Roderick. So in case you don't know, Father Roderick, he started SQPN, which is the network we're on and I run. And he's now off doing a new thing, but he still has podcasts that he does. And he talks about things that he's cooking and recipes he makes. And over the summer, he talked about this pasta dish he used to get at a restaurant in Rome called Lavatoria, because he went to school in Rome and has spent a lot of time in Rome. And this dish was the best dish ever. Then it wasn't on the menu the next time he went to Rome. So he asked them about it and they made it for him. And he ended up wanting to figure out how to make it and did some research. It was in a cookbook, but he wasn't going to buy this cookbook just for this one recipe. But he found the ingredient list on a website that shows ingredients that are in recipes in cookbooks, but doesn't give the whole recipe. It's very interesting. I figure I could look it up, but there's a website that does that. Anyway, and he recreated the recipe, and it sounded really good. And I realized, I think I have this cookbook. Turns out he was talking about the Vatican Cookbook, which is a cookbook that was created by the Swiss Guard. I mean, for the Swiss Guard. It has something to do with the Swiss Guard. A lot of the recipes are the recipes that they eat, both Italian recipes and Swiss recipes, or really German and French recipes, plus the favorite recipes of Pope John Paul, Pope Benedict, and Pope Francis. So Polish, German, and
it's kind of
Argentinian recipes.
Right. It's kind of a fun cookbook because it's got a little bit of lots of things.
Mm-hmm. And then recipes that are the favorites of certain curial officials, some cardinals who are from different places. So there's some variety in there. And then this one section was their favorite restaurant recipes. And it included this recipe that Father Roderick was talking about from Lavatoria called Pasta alla Califa. Or in the cookbook, it's Fusilli alla Califa.
Which I suppose if you're the Swiss Guard, you can get the recipe from the restaurant?
Well, since it's not on the menu anymore, that's probably why they were able to get it.
Hmm.
You know? And yeah, they probably said, you know, it was probably like, we're very flattered to be in the Vatican cookbook. And now people who get the Vatican cookbook are going to go to Rome on vacation and go, I want to go to this restaurant, Lavatoria, which now I want to go. So I made the recipe and it is very simple. It's basically, bacon or guanciale. Guanciale is or pancetta, actually, was what we used. The recipe in the cookbook says bacon. Now, so I want to say something about the recipes in the cookbook. The recipes read like a non-cook translated the recipes from Italian. So there are some references to certain ingredients that are sort of unconventional, or instead of saying chop, it says cut into, like, it just uses non-standard cookbook language. Like, cookbooks have a way of referring to things. Gosh, I wish I had the cookbook with me right now. I'd look at it and tell you exactly what it was that it triggered that. But so, for example, it says bacon in the recipe. Well, in Lavatoria in Rome, they're not pulling out Oscar Mayer bacon, you know, hickory smoked. They're using pancetta, which is the Italian bacon. But of course, on the other hand, Italians are known for, Italian cooks use what's at hand. So in America, they wouldn't expect to have pancetta. They would have American bacon and they would use American bacon. So I actually ended up using a combination of pancetta and American bacon because it calls for a lot of bacon, which just makes one of the reasons why this is such a good dish. Bacon.
It's bacon.
Yep. Then the bacon, and then into the bacon, what do I throw? Oh, let me open up the recipe now because I can't do it right off the top of my head like that anymore because I'm old and my mind is going. So pasta alla Califa, it's a bacon. Then you take some tomatoes, Roma tomatoes that you've peeled, you blanched and peeled and cut up. And those go into the, actually you put mushrooms in. So it's got mushrooms, then parsley and basil, cook those up. Then you add the tomatoes, you cook those up. You throw in the pasta that's been cooked. So it's al dente pasta already cooked. Put that in. Then you pour in, heavy cream, cook it for a minute. And then you mix in a whole bunch of pecorino romano cheese. This is one of the things that it says, a sprinkle with pecorino cheese and serve. Well, the recipe calls for, I scaled it up to 2 times so it would feed the whole family. 6 ounces of grated Pecorino. 6 ounces of grated Pecorino cheese is a lot of cheese. This isn't a sprinkle. This is a pour and dump. What I should have done, though, is add stir, because it did kind of clump a little. So that's one thing to think about when you make, if you make it. But what did you think of the dish, Melanie?
It was really good. Yeah. It was very rich, and I would probably have been happy with it as kind of like the soup, an appetizer.
Yeah, the pasta course.
Right. You know, with a salad and then like maybe a meat,
a small and vegetable piece of chicken or
dish. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as a main course, it was fine, but I think my favorite way to eat it would probably be like a small bowl.
It's a very rich dish, and it would work well as a secondo piatti, you know, instead of a primo piatti, or the pasta course at an Italian restaurant, as opposed to the typical American thing, which is we make the big pasta dish as the main course of a meal. So, but definitely really good, would make again. So I really thank you, Father Roderick, for putting that bug in my ear.
Yeah, it was fun.
And Sophie really loved it.
She did.
She had actually for her second lunch today, or pre-lunch, or some whatever it was, she had some. So that was good. So let's talk about what we've been reading and watching at this point. You wanted to talk about an older movie that you've watched again.
Yes, a friend of mine this week was asking for recommendations for romantic comedy. She says, I don't really like romantic comedies, but I'm kind of doing some research and I would like, you know, what if you're like going to watch just one or two romantic comedies, what would you watch? And so she got a whole bunch of suggestions. And my suggestions of my top two romantic comedies are Return to Me and 50 First Dates. And anybody who knows me would be surprised at 50 First Dates because I do not like Adam Sandler. I really do not like Adam Sandler, except I really loved this movie. And I liked Adam Sandler in this movie, except there was a little bit too much crass humor, which I thought could have been edited out without any damage to the movie at all. I would have liked it a lot
because
better.
Because it is,
that.
After all, an Adam Sandler
it
movie.
It is, after all, an Adam Sandler movie. But it's really sweet. I really, really like the romance in it. So the romantic lead opposite Adam Sandler is Drew Barrymore, who is just super cute. And the premise is that Drew Barrymore, about a year previous to the movie, got into a car accident and lost her ability to form short-term memories. So she wakes up every morning thinking it's the day of the accident. She remembers everything up to that day. And then as soon as she goes to sleep at night, like all the things that happened the day before are gone. So she wakes up every day thinking it's that particular day, which happened to have been her dad's birthday. They were going to go pick a pineapple, which was their family tradition.
They're in Hawaii,
which is about the only way you could get away with this, right?
Because the weather would have to be the same every day.
So her family's way of coping with this, because it became really hard to every day explain to her that she had lost all of her memories. So her dad and her brother have worked out this elaborate plan where they relive the day over and over and over again. Every day they
reset everything.
They reset, including like putting the right amount of shampoo back into the bottle so that it's always like the exact right level. And so every day she goes out to the cafe where she always used to eat lunch, a breakfast on Sundays, because for her, it's always Sunday.
Every day is Sunday, yeah.
And she expects to go pick a pineapple with her dad, and they have birthday cake, and she gives him the same movie, and they have to watch it every single day. And her dad and brother are obviously doing this painstaking routine out of love for her. And she doesn't appreciate it because she doesn't know what they're doing.
Right.
In walks Adam Sandler. He eats breakfast at the cafe, flirts with her, they hit it off, and she makes a date with him to have breakfast tomorrow. So he shows up the next day and she has no idea who he is. And the people who work in the cafe, the who run it, are very protective of her because they're part of
they
the,
would have to be.
They're
part yeah.
of the, they're in on the hoax, so to speak. Anyway, Adam Sandler is at first warned off of her, but he decides to sort of take it as a personal challenge. So he ends up setting up a roadblock on the road where she always drives and like finds ways to stop her, like pretending he has car troubles and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's over and over and over again, he figures out like the best ways to woo her. Sometimes he totally bats out. Sometimes
it's kind of like Groundhog Day in reverse.
In reverse, right?
Where she's reliving the he's sort of like in the Bill Murray position, which is he knows it's not the same day every day, but she thinks it is,
right? Anyway, at first, her father and brother are very protective and kind of want to drive him off. And then they start to notice that the days when she meets him, she seems happier and she wakes up happier the next day, too. And so she enjoys spending time with him. He makes her life better. And of course, there's complications and stuff. It's a romantic comedy. But I really love the way he's a very despicable character at the beginning. He uses women. He deliberately dates tourists so that he doesn't have to have any long-term commitments. And so it's ironic that, of course, he ends up dating the girl who he could have as many flings with as he wants with no long-term consequences because she won't remember him the next day. And yet he becomes committed to helping her to remember him by making her a videotape, which she can watch every day, which reminds her of who he is. He goes to all this great trouble to remind her that he loves her and she loves him and they want to have a life together.
Interesting. And so 50 dates.
Right. So there's a cute little shtick where like they kiss for the first time and she's like, oh, a first kiss. It's so wonderful. And he's like, yeah, you've said that every time. You always say that.
Yeah.
And there's something incredibly sweet about it. And I really can't quite put my finger on what I found so compelling about this movie. But I have to say, I found it just as compelling this time as I did the first time I watched it, which was like more than 10 years ago.
There's something about the bittersweetness of the person who doesn't remember you or doesn't remember every day, which is it's a lot like people who have, Alzheimer's or other memory loss.
Right. The self-sacrificial love of pouring yourself out for somebody who
can't remember and appreciate it.
Right. There's a sort of a purity to that self-sacrifice.
Mm.
And I don't know. It's just especially the transformation of Adam Sandler's character from being this sort of gross womanizer to being this selfless person who just
love really transforms him.
Right.
Which is, again, like Bill Murray's character in Groundhog Day. He starts off as this despicable person, but by the end, because he has to love purely, because it's the only thing left, is to just love with no recompense.
Right. Well, in a way, it really is kind of the same, because Andy McDowell doesn't remember Bill Murray in the same way that Drew Barrymore doesn't remember Adam Sandler.
Right.
Every day he has to woo her. He has to go on his experience of the day before, but nothing else.
Right.
Like his experience of knowing her for many days before, but he has to start again with a blank slate every day, making her fall in love with him again.
I mean, that's the idea of you always being at that, having to try to make that other the other person fall in love with you every day. You know, we kind of rely on each other's memory of being in love.
Right.
You know, and there are many days where we're just, you just kind of phoning it in because for whatever reason, you're not feeling well, it's an off day, whatever. But you just like we've built a life of love.
Right. And you're banking on some of those stored up memories on your bad days. Whereas in Adam Sandler's case, he can't have a bad day.
Right. Because she won't like him on his bad day.
Right.
For the first time. He'll make a bad first impression.
Of course, as the movie goes on, she sort of becomes a collaborator with him, giving him suggestions for what he might try to win her over the next day.
Right.
Buy me lilies. I love lilies. I that sort of thing.
Right. It's interesting. To win her over even quicker. Right.
Right.
Yeah,
because she sort of feels benevolent towards her future self, wanting her to have a good experience with him again.
And have a she's having such a good time. She doesn't want to waste time tomorrow getting to that point. Yeah. Interesting. I have seen the movie. It's just been a long, long time, and I don't really remember it. So I probably should watch it again.
It's free with Amazon Prime.
I may put that on the list for Secrets of Movies and TV Shows and see if I can get a panel together who'd like to talk about it. Because it does seem like it's got a lot of those themes that would be worth examining.
I think so.
I'll throw that out as a suggestion to the group. So the other thing we watched, we finished the second season of Umbrella Academy. We had talked about watching that.
Yes. I really liked the ending of the season.
Yeah, it was a little rough in the middle. And this brings up a point I wanted to kind of mention, which is just the state of current like TV, streaming TV especially. Like in a lot of TV series are now, they're not episodic, 23 different stories. We've really, I think Lost was a big key to changing this. We've really now gotten fully into the story arc kind of story. And because seasons are a certain length, you know, these streaming seasons are 10 episodes, 11 or 12 at most, maybe 13. They've got to make the story fill out that whole arc. And sometimes there's just not enough story to fill it.
I felt like that some of the middle episodes were a little thin.
That's my point. There was a couple of those middle episodes kind of dragged a bit. There was a lot of like sitting around and moping about relationships, which. I mean, I don't have a problem with the relationship aspects.
But right. In fact, some of the most compelling things about this season were the
relationships. Yeah. But that said, it was, I agree with you. It was a really interesting season and a complete story from start to finish. The usual caveats apply. A little more gore at points.
Yeah, there was
a couple points where, why?
I could do without that.
Didn't need to see that. A couple of things where it was certain kinds of relationships. I don't want to get into that, but there were certain kinds of relationships that like they're kind of in your face and you're going, well, last season that person wasn't like that. Like, why is this person like it now? And there was a tendency, which a lot of TV does, to portray people from Texas, especially people from Texas from several decades ago, as backward and racist. And I mean, which doesn't mean that they weren't racists, but it sort of felt a little over the top in its portrayal of basically almost every white person from 1963. They go back in Devon in 1963 that they met was really kind of awful.
Except for the
crazy guy.
Right. That's true. Right.
And, you know, and the mom and son that's a special case. But like almost every other person encountered, certainly every man they encountered was kind of like, I don't know if you noticed that, but there was it kind of bugged me a little bit. Not enough to make me say, oh, I shouldn't have watched that. But there was this niggling like, ugh, do we have to, you know, keep doing this? But that said, there were some interesting twists, especially at the end. The last episode.
Yes.
Some revelation.
Very, very satisfactory plot twists. Yes. I liked.
They held something back. It didn't feel like artificially held back. But it opens up the possibilities for season 3.
Yes.
And they closed some loops from season 1.
I really liked the fact that they closed some of the big dramatic tension was resolved in a way that was incredibly satisfactory. I really liked some of the character arcs.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that all of the characters, the main characters in the Umbrella Academy, they all had very satisfactory character growth through this episode.
Right. There was that one character, I don't want to spoil anything, but there was one character who came to a resolution point.
Yes.
That was extremely satisfactory. I really liked it. I don't want to say anything else. I would say would probably be spoilery, so I won't say more than that. But
I feel like this is one I want to talk about, but I don't want to spoil it. So
yeah, I mean maybe you and I could do a Secrets, Movies, and TVs about Umbrella Academy where we could talk about all that stuff.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, I think maybe that would be. Yeah, cool. So we saw that, and then I've just today finished reading the latest Star Wars book called Chaos Rising, Thrawn Ascendancy, Book 1. So a little backstory on this. The character of Grand Admiral Thrawn was a book character originally. So after Return of the Jedi, there was the great wasteland of Star Wars, where there was no new Star Wars on the horizon. And all we had were these books that had been written by this author named Timothy Zahn, this trilogy that featured this very different Imperial Admiral, Grand Admiral Thrawn. He was blue-skinned with red eyes and was a strategic and tactical genius who gained insight into how to beat you on the battlefield by the art of your culture. He understood your culture and the way you think by the artwork of your people. Kind of interesting. And he was the only alien. As you know, the Empire was biased against non-humans, but he was an alien there. And so after the Emperor was dead, he was the guy. All right. So that was those trilogy of books. Fans love them. 11, 12 comes around. Disney buys Star Wars and announces that everything non-movie before they bought it has now been relegated to what they call legend status, i.e. it's no longer canon. However, they were going to bring certain things back in over time. And of course, one of those things was Grand Admiral Thrawn. So in the Star Wars Rebels series, they brought him back to be a character in that. And he's slightly changed because the premises that they had him come back in the books had been changed by the things they had changed in Star Wars. All right. That's a long setup for this. So Timothy Zahn has written new books telling the story of where did Thrawn come from and who he is and what made him who he is. And so this, we've already seen the books where it was how he became an Imperial officer, but this goes even further back to when he was with his own people in the wild, unknown regions of the galaxy, et cetera, et cetera. What makes this book interesting is it's almost entirely not a Star Wars book. You could have totally sold this as there's a handful of things that happen in this book that are related to the Star Wars we know, but almost everything else could have just been a straight up science fiction space novel set in its own universe, which is
interesting.
It makes it really good. There are hints of the Force, the people who are Force sensitive. At some point he runs into Republic, so the Clone Wars era, Anakin Skywalker, and has an adventure that actually occurs in one of the other books that Zahn had already written. So this is when it happens. But it's a really good book. Thrawn is an incredibly interesting character. I really like it. I think Timothy Zahn has done some great work with this series. Like, he's basically written this character in two different series, like two different stories, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah.
He's like taking this character that I wrote 20 years ago, 20 some odd years ago, 30 years ago. I'm sorry. I keep forgetting how old I am. Like almost 30 years ago. And now I'm redoing it. It's kind of fascinating.
But redoing it as the backstory.
But even the only thing that's the same are the top layer stuff. He will be eventually, from the point of view of this book I read, he will be a Grand Admiral in the Imperial Navy. He is an expert in strategy and tactics by understanding art, that sort of stuff. But almost everything else in his race is the same. But almost everything else is different. Like, none of this had been developed before, but almost everything else is different. Like, you just can't rely on it being the same.
So it's really not in the same. I mean, like, this isn't going to develop into the second, the older stuff. Like,
right. The older stuff is off the table. The older stuff is like set aside now. This is developing into something new.
It's kind of confusing.
Well, yeah, Star Wars fans have had to deal with the confusing aspect of the old stuff being thrown into, again, legend status or non-canon. And there were lots of stuff that were, I mean, in the old stuff, Han and Leia got married and they had three kids, Anakin, Jason, and Jaina. Jason and Jaina were twins and they were Jedi. And Anakin was a powerful Jedi who was tempted to the dark side. And eventually, I think he ends up turning. I stopped watching those. Oh, and Chewbacca died in those books. Like, they had a moment where he died. And, like, all these other things. And Luke gets married to Mara Jade. And all this other stuff that was in there is all gone. The stories of Darth Plagueis. And Darth Plagueis is actually in the movies, but the name is. But who he was and how. All that stuff. So, it's fascinating. If you want to hear more about that, if you're a Star Wars fan, you should listen to The Secrets of Star Wars, which our girls are like nuts about that podcast.
They really are.
They're like the number one fans of Secrets of Star Wars. It's funny. So the only other thing I want to mention about, like, for reading and watching is I watched the first episode of a new Netflix series called Away. It's about a Mars mission in the near future. It's an international mission. So the commander is a woman, American astronaut. The second command is a Russian male astronaut. There's the co-pilot is an Indian guy. There's also a Chinese woman scientist and a British African origin, you can say African-American, African-British Muslim man scientist. And in the first episode, there's a lot of stuff like having to do with, like, they're leaving for 3 years. She's a mother and wife, and her husband has a sickness, and she's leaving them, and how could she go, and maybe she shouldn't go, and then there's these interpersonal problems, and it could be interesting. I'm a little worried it's going to be very soap opera-y, like soap opera in space-ish, which I wouldn't enjoy, but I might give it another episode and check it out.
You never know.
Yeah. It's Hilary Swank. She's okay. She bugs me a little bit. I don't know what it is. You ever notice, like, there's a way some people talk, the way they move their mouth, that it looks kind of odd? She does this. It's like she's rolling her lips over her teeth or something. I don't know what it is. Did you ever like, notice someone doing
that? I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay. So maybe I'm alone in this, but there's something, the way that her mouth moves when she talks, that seems very strange. Anyway, so that's what we've been reading and watching.
Okay.
I'll end on my strange obsession with the way Hilary Swank talks.
Yeah,
let's move on from that.
Let's do that.
So Mass today was your turn to take those who were going.
My turn
to Mass.
Yes.
A live stream from a parish, and this time I couldn't find the live stream when it was the appointed time. It's usually streamed to our parishes. Our parish collaborative, so it's three parishes, the tri-parishes of Brockton, is usually streamed to their Facebook page. Wasn't there. So maybe sometimes it's streamed to the Cape Verdean community page. Wasn't there. I'm waiting. And then finally it shows up on the Cape Verdean page, shared from the Brockton Soccer Club page, because the guy who streams it for the church, the Mass for the churches, also must stream their games and accidentally started sending it to the wrong.
He seems to be very busy on social media in many different, with many different hats. He also, yes,
he's a DJ.
He's also a DJ. And I have actually watched one of his DJ programs. He DJs like Cape Verdean music videos on Facebook. He linked to one of them to the parish's Cape Verdean community page one day, and I was like, it's pandemic, I'm bored, I'll watch it. It was cool. Like, I don't know anything about Cape Verdean music. It was really, I liked the songs.
Cool.
So yeah,
so we missed the opening prayers in the first reading, but we got to there as the psalm was being sung. And the celebrant this week was Father Irineau.
I love Father Irineau. He was our Cape Verdean pastoral associate for many years. I think starting from the time when we arrived at
Was he? Because Father Garcia was the Haitian priest, and Father Irineau was there.
Right.
Yeah.
But a couple years ago, he was reassigned actually to go study in Rome, and we got a new Cape Verdean pastoral associate, Father Joachim. No, actually, we had Father Miracle and then Father Joachim or something like that.
Yeah.
We've had a few. But then Father Irineau came back this summer.
Midst of the pandemic.
In the midst of the pandemic.
Because the schools were closed in Rome? I don't know the story.
I haven't heard the story.
But he's seems like he's here now.
He's now being listed in the bulletin as a pastoral associate for the collaborative. So it looks like at least on a semi-permanent basis,
he ain't going back
for the time being. Anyway, I really, really like him, and it's nice to have him back. And he's always a great homilist.
Well, the funny thing is before he left, I think he's not confident in his English. His English is fine. It's heavily accented, but it's fine. But
I get the feeling that he doesn't have that confidence about his English speaking abilities.
Because it was always the deacons preaching at his masses, which was annoying because apart from Deacon Chris, Father Irno's a better homilist. I mean, it's just a fact. I mean, no disrespect intended for the other deacons, Deacon Bob and Deacon Phil. But Father Irno, I just love to hear his homilies, and he didn't disappoint this time.
No, he's a very powerful speaker, and he's really
always get that deep voice.
And he's very insightful. I always feel like I walk away being very nourished by his homilies.
So today's gospel, the readings were about forgiveness. So it was the forgiving the debt, the debtor, you know, you must forgive 7 times 7 or 77 times. It was the new translation because we can't understand math, apparently, in the Bible. Then the NAB has changed. Remember, it used to be, I say to you, not 7 times, but 7 times 70 times or 7 times 7.
Something.
I forget, but now it just says 77 times. Anyway, that's Bible translations. So then the ungrateful servant whose debt is forgiven by the master, who could have legally and justly thrown him into prison, debtor's prison.
He was going to throw him into debtor's prison.
Who had compassion and mercy. And so this guy who's now debt free leaves the presence of his master, walks out into the hall, sees somebody else who has some money and says, hey, starts throttling him. You owe me money.
He doesn't just say you owe me money. He starts choking the guy. I mean,
pay
wow.
back what you owe. And then when the guy, just like he did 5 minutes ago, falls to his knees and begs, he says, nope, I'm putting you in debtor's prison. Which when you think about debtor's prison, like, how do you pay back a debt when you're in prison? You don't.
Presumably, you hope that your friends and family will collect enough money to pay off your debt.
And if they don't, you stay there.
Right.
So he throws him in debtor's prison. And then the fellow servants, who's like, this jerk, he needs to get what's coming to him. He's like, because they probably already hated him. Right.
I'm gonna guess he's the kind of guy who's lending money to his fellow servants at usurious rates, and then
when he doesn't pass on the compassion that he's received, like he's that type of guy. So they went and told the master, and the master said, "You wicked servant," and threw him over not just into debtor's prison to the torturers until he paid back the whole debt.
Yeah, I noticed the torturers, but ouch.
Yes. That's heavy duty. So, but Father Irno's homily was really good because he focused on forgiveness.
Right.
He said forgiveness is a central characteristic of the Christian life, not just love, but forgiveness.
Because forgiveness is the prerequisite to love. You can't love when you've got something that's between you and the other person.
He said the ability to love is dependent on our ability to forgive.
Right. We literally can't love the other person if we are angry with them and holding on to a grudge and refusing to forgive them.
Forgiveness brings healing. And he said forgiveness can be difficult. You know, we were talking about just before we started recording, we're talking about the idea of nursing a grudge, nursing your anger. In fact, the first reading, Sirach says, wrath and anger are hateful things, yet the sinner hugs them tight.
Hugs them tight, right.
There's that phrase in English, you know, he always nursing a grudge. And when you think about it, when you're nursing a grudge, like a mother nursing, you are feeding it with your very essence. It is a most intimate act.
Right.
And that's your grudge. That's your unforgiveness, your anger and wrath.
I think Evelyn Waugh uses a variation on that phrase in Brideshead Revisited. He talks about Julia nursing her sin.
Right.
Carrying the sin around like a child and feeding it and nursing it.
Right.
And there's a beautiful scene, beautifully written, but it really captures that that tendency that we can sometimes have to not just to refuse to let go, but to kind of have this cherishing aspect of the things that the resentments and things that we hold against other people.
Right. And so what Father said was, and he says that the whole point is we have to be able to forgive each other. If people, this is what he said, if people would not forgive one another and graciously accept forgiveness from others, that's just as important to accept forgiveness, then they would not be able to accept God's forgiveness.
Right.
And it's important, like God forgives us, but you have to be able to accept it. If you don't accept God's forgiveness, you're still injuring yourself with your sin.
Right, because God is always willing to forgive. Like, his door is always open. The forgiveness is out there for the taking. We just have to repent and accept it.
Exactly. And so, it was such a good homily. So very good. I mean, there was a lot more. The bit I noted, too,
was that it is the deepest of God's desires on our behalf that we forgive.
Right.
His deepest desire is for us to forgive each other and to accept mercy and to reconcile with each other.
When you think about it, Jesus came not just to love, because God loves all of us. Jesus came to forgive sin. He died for us to be forgiven from our sin. He died to lift the debt. His death lifts that debt that we owe from our sin. Forgiveness is the central, like the Eucharist is the source and summit of life, but confession and forgiveness is central to the Christian life, which is a shame that it's so hard to get to confession now, especially in the pandemic days, at least around here. But it is vital. It is not optional. And why one of the reasons why I think so much has gone wrong in the church is because so few people go to confession anymore. And because it got downplayed after Vatican II and the 60s, and there was fewer opportunities for confession. I mean, I remember the stories like Father Murphy used to tell me back in the day that Saturday night was confession night. Everybody went to confession Saturday afternoon. Everybody went to confession Saturday afternoon. There were no vigil masses. There was no Saturday night mass. And so that's what Saturday afternoon and evening was for. And the priests would all be in the church for hours. And then the youngest of the parochial vicars, or the curates, they called them at the time, would leave about a half hour early before the end of confession and go back to the rectory and mix up the martinis. It's a very Boston priest thing.
Yeah.
Of a time. You know, the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. I remember those funny stories. But everybody went. You know, all the families went to confession. It was just the thing you did. And there's not as much of that now. It's hard. We've lost the culture of confession. But it's good. Like, confession is good for the soul. It unburdens us, and it brings us back into relationship with God and allows us to accept that God loves us. It's hard to accept that God loves you if you think he's holding something against you, if there's something between you. You know, I mean, when there's something between us, you know, I really feel like we need to clear the air. We need to remove this so that we can have remove any barriers and obstacles to love. So, Good homily. Brought up a lot of good thoughts today, and especially, of course, good readings. So I always like these ones. I just think it's a funny gospel. Like this, he starts choking the guy. I mean, just the imagery of it. Anyway, I think that should about do it for today. So, as we always want to do, we want to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including this time Patrick D, Jonathan M, Megan F, Patrick R, and Stephen C. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And if you become a patron by the end of September, you will be entered into a drawing. I'm from Boston. You could be entered into a drawing to win one of 16 packages, verbum.com, the Catholic Scripture Study packages. These are worth anywhere from a few hundred dollars up to several thousand dollars. They're basically digital libraries. And they're not just for like scripture scholars. They also have devotional stuff. Like you can do daily lectionary study, daily like the divine office and devotionals and that sort of thing. So anyone who's a patron, an active patron by the end of September, will be entered into the drawing. And so we're going to be giving those away. So if you want to become a patron,
it's a good time.
And you're helping us continue. And I do want to thank Verbum for supporting us with the donation of these packages. It's really, really great. So what did you think of our discussion? You can let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS, or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. I'll put links to the various things we talked about in our show on our show notes at sqpn.com. Another request, if you could, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from and write a review. Your reviews are invaluable. They really do help. And it's not just an ego thing. They actually help get the podcast in front of new people. The algorithms, when you write a review, it bumps it in front of more eyes. It just helps to get that in. So that's the number one way we get the podcast out there. And also the number two way is when you share the podcast with your friends, that helps us grow. So we really do appreciate it. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.